It's time to get organized this new year with Menards. Update your closet system and add style today with Closet Culture. Choose from two closet finishes and four colors of shelf boards to create a functional yet stylish closet solution that matches your home decor. Check out all our Closet Culture closet kits or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com to see all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. You know the mission here. We take something you see every day, something so foundational to our culture, you think you know everything about it.
And then we drill down.
We drill way down.
Yeah.
Beneath that surface narrative to find the, well, the historical truth, and sometimes it's pretty unsettling. Today, we're taking on maybe the most iconic piece of plastic ever made, the Barbie doll.
It really is a face that's defined, I mean, generations, childhoods, fashion, even global commerce for, what, 65 years now?
Right. But if you've ever really stopped and looked at that smile, that very specific permanent smile.
The one that hasn't changed.
It has not changed. And you might be picking up on something, a signal that her history is deeply unusual, maybe even sinister.
I think that's the right word for it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because our goal today is to go way beyond the official Mattel timeline, you know, the empowering stories we hear now.
We're going to unpack the true kind of obscured origins of Barbie, and we're pulling from historical accounts, from documented worker testimonials, and even internal reports.
And all together, they paint this picture that's like one part mid-century glamour and one part creeping horror.
It's a very real feeling. We're not here to analyze brand strategy. That's not the point. We're here to analyze the historical receipts.
The receipts.
The physical documented evidence that was created when the original artifact, the thing that became Barbie's face, started its journey.
A journey from post-war Berlin all the way to the American toy market.
Exactly. This story is really about mass production, sure, but it's also about identity and a profound act of historical erasure.
Okay, let's just boil this down.
Yeah.
If you hear nothing else today, this is the core of it. This is the real story behind Barbie, and it's darker than anyone wants to admit.
And that darkness isn't just a metaphor. It's not conceptual. It is physically attached to the product's origin, because before she was a doll, she was a woman.
A real woman.
A woman with a specific face, a face you weren't supposed to forget even after she vanished.
And the sources we're pulling from today, they're pretty robust. We have the foundational historical accounts of the original German doll, Bill Lilly.
Anchored by some very specific dates, like the critical year of 1954.
And crucially, we have those testimonials, the ones that are often ignored, from factory workers, warehouse staff, people who had direct contact with the original face mold during its transport.
And then there's the final piece. Internal company reports about a very strange incident that happened years later involving that exact same mold.
So we have to treat this like almost a forensic investigation.
We do. We're analyzing these receipts, these documented bits of evidence you find tucked away in, like shipping logs or old security reports.
To reconstruct this core, really unsettling narrative behind the world's most famous doll.
We need to understand not just that a face went from being a person to being plastic, but what exactly happened during that transition. What were the effects, physically and psychologically?
So to start this dive, we have to go back. Back to the 1950s. And we need to set the stage in two vastly different worlds.
Right. On one hand, you have 1950s America. It's booming.
Totally. Post-war prosperity, the baby boom is in full swing, and there's this huge demand for consumer goods, and, you know, especially for new toys.
Imaginative toys. And this is the environment that Mattel steps into when, in 1959, they launched the first Barbie.
And their official story is that she was inspired by a German doll.
That's the clean corporate version. But the source, the actual doll, comes from a culture that's a stark contrast to that American optimism.
You're talking about mid-century Berlin.
Mid-century Berlin, still grappling with recovery, still dealing with the shadows of its very recent past. The consumer psychology there was, well, it was far less innocent.
And the doll Mattel cited as their inspiration was called the Build Lily doll.
Build Lily. That's the name you have to remember. It's the anchor for everything else that happens.
Now, if you only know the official Mattel story, you'd just assume Build Lily was, I don't know, a European version of a fashion doll for kids, right?
Maybe a little more sophisticated, a bit old-fashioned, but ultimately a toy for girls.
But that's the first huge misconception, the one we have to just tear down right now.
Absolutely correct. The source material, all of it, is unequivocal on this. And this is the crucial distinction. Build Lily was not for children.
Never.
She was never marketed as a child's toy. Her design, her clothes, even where she was sold, it all confirms she was an adult-oriented novelty item.
Okay, explain what adult-oriented means in this context.
Hmm.
Because for most people listening, that jump from adult novelty to, you know, the world's biggest children's icon is, it's a massive leap.
It is. She was basically a satire, a caricature of a specific type of woman you'd see in post-war Germany. Sometimes racy, a sort of good time girl.
So where would you buy one? Not a toy store, I'm guessing.
No, no. She was often sold in tobacco shops, in bars, or in gift shops that were aimed squarely at adult men.
A gag gift.
Exactly. She was frequently bought as a gag gift for bachelor parties, or you'd see her hanging from the rearview mirror of a car. The whole context was adult. It was suggestive. She was the absolute antithesis of the idealized American teenager Mattel would later create.
That context just changes everything. So you have this doll marketed as a pinup or a caricature.
A very adult, fixed object.
And what Mattel wanted was purely the look, that specific recognizable facial structure.
But it gets deeper and, frankly, more unsettling than just her market category. The sources, they reveal the identity behind the doll's face.
It wasn't just a drawing.
No. Build Lily was modeled specifically directly after a real woman named Lily.
A specific named person who was alive at the time. This wasn't some artistic composite or a sketch from someone's imagination.
Not at all. It was a portrait, just rendered in plastic. She's documented as being a model and a bit part actress.
Working in Berlin.
Right. Active in Berlin during that immediate post-war period. And her distinct features, her gaze, the specific shape of her lips, her smile, that was the blueprint. Her living face was literally translated into a mass-produced mold.
Let's just sit with the implications of that for a second. This is not like hiring a hand model for a lotion ad. This is taking the most expressive, identifiable part of a human being, their entire face, and committing it to a mold that's designed for thousands and then millions of replications.
It's an act of permanent capture, unauthorized capture.
It's the ultimate appropriation, a photograph. You know, it captures a moment, but a mold.
A mold captures a fixed identity. It freezes that identity into an industrial matrix designed to last forever.
And it gives that person zero control over how their own face is then used and consumed.
Especially when it becomes a gag gift in a smoker's shop. The analogy is just so stark. Imagine an artist makes a hyper-realistic 3D portrait of you, and then a giant corporation buys the rights to mass-produce copies of your face as a satirical item.
And once you accept that the face is a portrait of a real person, the whole dynamic of this doll just shifts. Mm. It's not an abstract toy anymore.
It's a living photograph.
And that, right there, brings us to the actual heart of this whole historical mystery.
Mm.
So we have the real Lily, the model, and we have Build Lily, the adult novelty doll.
Yeah.
And now we hit the critical and, frankly, terrifying pivot point in this whole timeline, the year 1954. The sources are almost chillingly precise about this date.
1954 is what we're calling the banishing anchor. The documentation confirms that Lily, the model and actress working in Berlin, mysteriously vanished during that year.
Vanished how?
We don't have clear public records on the circumstances, no details, only that she simply ceased all documented activity, all visibility. She was just gone.
And the timing, the contrast in the timeline, is where this whole story just gets so much darker. The sources say it was only about 1 month later.
1 month.
That shops in Germany began selling these dolls that looked exactly like the missing woman. And the sales just took off.
The efficiency of it is what's so disturbing. It suggests the mold was either ready to go immediately or, and this is darker, that her disappearance somehow acted as a morbid catalyst for the launch.
But the key is the detail. It wasn't just a vague resemblance. These things were forensic copies.
Let's nail down those specific, uncanny details from the source material, because this is the undeniable link. It wasn't just the general look.
No.
The doll had the same unmistakable smile, the same intensity in the eyes, which were described as piercing.
And the most damning detail.
Her beauty mark.
The beauty mark on her cheek. The exact same one.
That beauty mark is the signature. It's the unique non-generic identifier that links this plastic replica, irrevocably, back to the specific person who had just vanished.
So the doll stopped being merely inspired by Lily.
It became a tangible, portable, mass-produced representation of her last known appearance.
Okay, I have to play the skeptic here for a minute. It's the 1950s. Mm-hmm. Making a detailed facial mold that quickly is impressive, sure, but... Is it possible the timing is just a coincidence?
How so?
That her disappearance and the doll's wash happening so close together is a coincidence, and the resemblance was just, you know, heightened by local gossip? The media focuses on a missing person, and suddenly people see her face everywhere.
That's a fair challenge, a logical one. But the sources we have, they really push back against simple coincidences, mainly through the psychological reports from that time.
Witness reports.
Exactly. Yes, local gossip could heighten a resemblance. But these reports focus on the effect the early dolls had, especially on people who actually knew Lily or who saw her around Berlin.
So they weren't just seen as novelties.
They were seen as uncanny portraits. The witness reports are just incredibly unsettling. People weren't just saying, oh, that looks a bit like her.
They were reporting something active.
Precisely. The reports quote, witnesses saying that the dolls seemed to watch people from behind the glass displays.
Seemed to watch them.
That goes so far beyond simple recognition. It suggests an active presence.
I want to break down that feeling of being watched for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Our brains are wired to see static objects as, well, inanimate. They're just things.
Right.
But when an inanimate object has such hyper-realistic, specific, detailed features of a person who has just ceased to exist, someone whose face was alive a month ago.
It creates a cognitive dissonance.
Exactly. I feel like the face is still functional, still observing, even though you know it's just plastic.
It's the visual weight of a human identity trapped in an object. Those eyes, specifically called piercing, combined with that distinct, unchanging smile. It creates a gaze that seems to follow you.
But not like an old painting, not an optical illusion.
No, it's because the features are too specific, too personal. It shifts the doll from being a consumer product into being this persistent, unsettling monument to a missing woman.
So now you have this proxy of a vanished person, and it's dominating the adult novelty market in Germany.
And this proxy, carrying that specific unforgettable smile, is about to take a trip across the Atlantic.
And this is where the story shifts again. It goes from this localized Berlin horror story to a global corporate acquisition.
Mattel.
Mattel sees the potential in the aesthetic and the look of the doll, and they purchase the rights to build Lily.
With the full intention of sanitizing her, redesigning her for the booming American children's market.
And this is the moment where the uncanny officially enters the logistical record. Because when Mattel bought the rights, they didn't just buy a drawing or a concept.
No, they needed the actual artifact, the essential piece of evidence in our whole deep dive, the original physical thing used to capture Lily's face.
The sources confirm it. The original mold used to create Lily's face was shipped to the United States.
For future use, for redesign.
The physical matrix of a vanished woman's face, sealed in a crate, shipped across an ocean. And this journey is where we get the most tangible, documented receipts.
From the people who were just paid to handle the cargo.
We have to focus really heavily on the reports from this transport phase. These are accounts from...
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
You know, factory guys, warehouse workers.
People who are focused on inventory and security, not on folklore.
And they provide two specific, highly disruptive accounts. So let's start with the first receipt. This one is about sound.
Okay.
Workers reported hearing faint female laughter echoing from the crates, the ones that were sealed for transport.
Okay, let's put some friction on that. Can we rationalize this? Warehouses are noisy places. Ships are noisy.
Right.
Could it have been material shifting inside the crate? The resonance of the ship's engine, even just rats, maybe, that the workers misinterpreted because they already knew the doll's uncanny origin story.
That's a perfectly rational argument.
Yeah.
But the documentation is so specific. Faint female laughter.
It's not just a noise.
No. If it were random noise, they'd report scratching or tapping or a thump. The specificity of laughter, a distinctly human, emotionally charged sound. It suggests a whole different category of phenomena.
It implies a kind of awareness inside the sealed box.
The specificity is absolutely key. Laughter implies a sentient reaction. It's almost like mockery or amusement at the situation. This face being captured, sealed up, shipped like cargo.
And for multiple isolated workers to all corroborate hearing something so specific at different points in the logistical chain, that suggests a documented auditory anomaly tied directly to the crate's contents.
This isn't just noise. It's a sound that implies a living presence interacting with its environment.
Which suggests consciousness, or at least a very sophisticated echo of one.
But the second receipt, I think this one is even more physically disturbing because it seems to violate the laws of material science.
Indeed. One worker swore the doll's hair had grown overnight.
Okay, what does that mean? Was there a doll in the crate with the mold?
The report suggests a prototype or a test cast was included in the crate. And the hair, of course, would have been synthetic, nylon probably, or a similar plastic fiber.
Right, so I have to push back even harder here. Hair growth is such a classic folklore trope, especially with objects tied to death or disappearance.
Of course.
Isn't it far more likely that humidity or temperature changes on a long ocean voyage caused the synthetic fibers to expand or relax? That could create the illusion of growth, and a worker just logged a sensationalized version of what he saw.
That is the necessary rational explanation. Synthetic fibers can and do react to their environment. But the sources describing the report, they insist on the word grown.
Not expanded.
No. They often compare the change to natural, organic growth, like real hair. We have to consider what the worker was actually logging. They weren't logging fiber expansion. They were logging a violation of the object's expected state. For them, it defied the material science of its own construction.
It violates the rules of the inanimate world.
Yes.
When a piece of plastic and nylon starts showing behaviors we associate with living tissue awareness, like laughter and organic change, like growth, it suggests that whatever energy was imprinted on that original mold is starting to manifest physically.
It's defying its synthetic housing.
So the analysis we have to pursue, based on this evidence, is that Mattel bought the rights to a doll, a plastic object.
But these receipts, they suggest they inadvertently acquired something far more complex, a kind of persistent energy or an unresolved identity connected directly to the missing woman whose face was the blueprint.
So by shipping the mold, they weren't just moving corporate assets, they were moving the physical proxy of the vanished Lily.
Complete with documented unsettling phenomena attached to it.
And this mold, this core artifact, it eventually settles into the Mattel corporate archives. And it stays there, silent, for years.
Until the day it was brought out for display.
So years go by. Barbie becomes this global icon, you know, completely sanitized, wildly successful. But that original mold.
The physical matrix of Lily's face. Okay. One that carried that documented history of laughter and growth.
It remained in Mattel's possession. It basically became a historical curiosity.
Which brings us to the climax of this whole thing. Act 3. The exhibition incident. The sources tell us that years later, Mattel organized this big retrospective exhibition of vintage Barbies, a celebration of the brand's history.
And we have to emphasize the setting. This wasn't some dusty storeroom. It was a controlled, high-security corporate exhibition.
Meticulous.
Dozens of dolls arranged in perfect, immaculate rows, all in secure glass display cases. It's the pinnacle of corporate presentation. It's designed to inspire nostalgia, reverence.
And it was right there, in that antiseptic controlled environment, that the chaos happened. The next morning, security staff made a discovery. One that was immediately classified and only leaked out later through internal reports.
And the primary incident they reported was this. The dozens of dolls, those perfectly arranged, pristine exhibits.
They were found scattered across the floor.
Just total disarray where there should have been perfect order.
Now, if it was just scattering, you know, a shelf bracket failed, something fell over, that's just an accident.
But the evidence suggests something else. It suggests coordination. And this is the crucial, chilling detail from the reports.
All of the scattered dolls, spanning different eras and designs, were all facing the same direction.
Staring.
They were staring intently at a single focal point.
The coordination implies intent. I mean, inanimate objects should scatter randomly if something hits them.
Right.
To find them all aligned, all staring, it suggests a collective act, a focus, like a pilgrimage towards something.
So what was the object of their attention?
It was a single, shattered display case. Not just cracked. The reports say it was physically broken.
And inside that case was the object of the doll's collective focus. The original mold of Build Lily.
The source material. The physical matrix of the face was the magnetic center of the room.
Now let's challenge the logic one more time. Could a rogue cleaning cart have hit a shelving unit, causing a collapse that scattered the dolls and then also happened to hit that one display case?
It's possible, I suppose. An external mechanical error. But the alignment defies that. A catastrophic accident might scatter the dolls, but it wouldn't orient them all to face one single, separate, shattered object.
The report suggests that the security staff focused on that unnatural alignment immediately. It was as if the dolls themselves, the plastic descendants, were acknowledging their progenitor.
And the mold itself. It had undergone one final physical change. One that was reported by the witnesses right there in the immediate aftermath.
The sources state that the mold's smile now appeared wider, more human.
Let's spend some time on that description. Wider, more human. That suggests a departure from the strict, stylized plastic look it had for decades.
It implies a softening of the edges, maybe an intensification of the human features, as if the fixed plastic smile was finally relaxing or achieving its final, true expressive state.
It suggests that whatever energy was present had fundamentally altered the physical blueprint of the face.
And if that mold is the foundational matrix for all future production and it physically changed its expression to become more human,
then the source of all future faces was actively transformed by this uncanny event.
So what was the corporate response to this documented incident of coordinated movement, a shattered case, an altered artifact?
Silence. Mattel quietly removed the mold from the exhibit. And they offered no explanation.
And the silence is the final confirmation, isn't it? If it was just an accident, a structural failure, they'd release a statement, a maintenance issue. Instead, they removed the central piece of evidence and enacted a corporate blackout. You don't erase an incident unless the real explanation is more damaging than the mystery.
They understood what they had. Dozens of inanimate objects that seemed to coordinate a focused reaction toward an artifact that was already documented to have exhibited organic change and an audible presence years before.
So the only logical corporate response was immediate sanitization, removal, and complete silence.
So we've traced this history from a vanished woman, Lily, to this uncanny replication, to a haunted mole that laughed and grew, and finally to these scattered, staring dolls at an exhibition.
But the story persists. It continues because the sources confirm this history is carried by every single product made since.
That's the enduring legacy. The sources state it clearly. Every new Barbie ever made still carries the exact same smile.
The mass production continues using a matrix derived from that original and now altered mold.
So let's analyze that persistent smile through this forensic lens. It is a mass production of a very specific facial expression.
An expression that we have documented evidence changed on the original mold during that exhibition incident. It became wider. More human.
Which means that the smile you see on a Barbie today is not just some pleasant design choice from the 50s.
No, it's a refined, maybe an amplified, or even a possessed expression derived from an artifact that seemed to be striving for a greater degree of humanity.
So subsequent generations of dolls, it doesn't matter what their hair color is or their fashion. They all descend from a blueprint whose expression was perfected or maybe fully realized by whatever happened that night.
I think the emotional implication here is that Mattel didn't just acquire a facial design, they acquired the physical impression of an unresolved fate.
And because every doll made since carries that enhanced, more human smile, it's like a worldwide mass-produced echo of a final, specific expression.
It connects right back to the beginning of our deep dive, the psychological effect on the original Berlin witnesses. If the first dolls seemed to watch people, how much more potent is that persistent gaze now?
Refined by the mold transformation and fixed onto millions and millions of faces around the globe.
Which brings us to the central ambiguity, the unanswered question that the historical record leaves us with, and it allows us to speculate.
Did that ubiquitous, unchanging smile truly belong to a doll, an idealized design? Or was it the captured, amplified, and now permanently fixed face of the missing Berlin woman, Lily?
And we have to label this as speculation, but it's speculation that is grounded directly in all the historical evidence we've just analyzed.
The uncanny resemblance, the rapid launch after her disappearance.
The reports of growth and laughter, the coordinated movement of the dolls, and the physical alteration of the mold itself.
if all the evidence points toward the doll being a sentient proxy for a vanished person,
mm-hmm.
a proxy that showed awareness and organic vitality,
then the persistence of that exact smile suggests that it's the person's identity that's the persistent element, not just the corporate brand design.
Her identity wasn't erased by the corporate acquisition.
It seems it was transposed onto the artifact. The smile is the final piece of evidence, constantly being manufactured, ensuring that the face of that missing model continues to look back at the world decades and decades after she disappeared.
It forces you to see the doll not as a product, but as a portrait.
A portrait whose subject may have never truly left the physical world, but was instead confined to a matrix that guarantees her face will be seen and owned by billions.
It's a profound thought that every time you see one of these dolls, you are engaging with the perpetually smiling, captured face of a woman who vanished in 1954.
An expression that became wider and more pronounced over time and never ever faded. It's the ultimate victory of identity over disappearance.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? It means the next time you see a Barbie doll, maybe it's in an old toy box or on a store shelf or even in a movie, you should pause.
Mm.
You should really reconsider the face that's staring back at you, knowing the dark, unsettling, and unresolved history carried by that persistent, specific, and ultimately human smile.
If every Barbie shares her smile, maybe the real Lily never stopped looking back.
And that is the thought that lingers long after this deep dive ends. For the full timeline, the direct historical accounts, and all the receipts concerning the workers' reports and the exhibition incident, everything we talked about today, check the episode notes.
And follow at Inspector Story for more true stories hiding inside pop culture. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.